Well, good morning, everyone. As has been mentioned now a number of times, some of us, maybe not all of us, are using this little booklet, People of God. This is now part two, and there's a Bible reading plan there. And the first week, we were in the book of Ruth, which is one of those books in the Bible. You know, there's some books in the Bible which it's, I don't know, how can I put this? It's sometimes a bit more challenging, or it's longer, or certainly you can't sort of read the whole thing in a week, or, you know, but there are a few books which are shorter and more self-contained, and Ruth is one of those books. Now, just quickly as well, just to say the purpose of these stories, the purpose of the program of reading the Bible in this way is really to look at the stories of, as the title suggests, the people of God, God's people, who are, as we read it again and again, we discover people just like you and me. Oh, hi guys, didn't see you there. Welcome back, Dave and Chloe, it's nice to see you. They're people, and as we read their stories of their lives, which at times seem extraordinary, but some of that's just because they lived a long time ago and the circumstances are different. If we really drill down into what's going on, the decisions they're making, what's going on in their emotions, in their hearts and all the rest of it, they're just people like us. And as we read those stories and read how they interact with this God that they are following, that they're trying to serve, that they're trying to get to know, that they're making mistakes in all of that, we can learn so much about our own condition. And that's certainly true in this book of Ruth that we will be looking at this morning. Because the more I've read through this week, and it's, you know, as I say, it's only four chapters, so you get the chance, actually, if you're preparing the talk, to read it through several times. The more I've read through it, the more I've seen that there's kind of two stories going on here. Can I just have a quick show of hands, just so I know something about who I'm talking to? Who's actually read the book of Ruth, either this week or, you know, you've read it and can remember. That's the majority, but not everyone. That's fine. Don't worry. You're not going to be left out. I will be taking us through the story. But there's kind of two stories going on. On the one hand, there is what essentially just reads like a love story, really. There's this human story that goes on. And like many love stories, it's got kind of most of the elements that you would expect. It's got, you know, there's moments of hope in the story, and then there's moments where everything seems to be going wrong, and there's tragedy, and then there's sort of, you know, initial explorations in terms of a love relationship, and then there's the hero coming through, and then there's a celebration in the end, and everything's great, and the family's brought back together, and there's new life, and all those wonderful things. And some of the guys are looking at me going, what are you on? But most of the women are kind of nodding, so that's good. But there's this fantastic love story going on at the human level. But behind the scenes, there is another love story going on. And that's the love story of God interacting with his creation, with people, with humanity, in ways that only he can, that interacts, that does intersect with the human story. It's not independent of the human story. Because God, the way that God tends to work with us is through our interaction, through our decisions, through the choices that we make. And we see that going on in this story, that woven into this and kind of behind the scenes of this human love story, there is a divine love story going on of the relationship of God with the people, humanity, that he created and that he loves. So kind of bear that in mind as we go through. If you want to go to sleep now, that's really my main point for this morning. That's how God works with us, and that's the relationship that he wants to have with us. But hopefully some of you will stay awake a little bit longer. In terms of the People of God series, part one was kind of the autumn term, September to December, and I think all of the stories really were primarily about men. And we wanted, I mean, it makes sense in terms of the timeline, but it's important that we're kicking off this season with a story that the main protagonist, the person who makes the story hang together, the person that the book is named after, is a woman. Because back in Genesis, where we started back in September, we read that in the sort of creation narrative there, it talks about male and female together being in the image of God. That there is no kind of, well, men first and women second. You know, it's none of that. It's men and women together made in the image of God to walk on this earth, to fulfill his image on the earth. And here we have that going on with Ruth. In terms of timeline, well, for those who know anything about sort of biblical timeline, we are in the time of the judges. The people of Israel have kind of moved into their promised land. They're kind of setting up shop there. And the way that they're ruled is by these people who are called the judges. They're not kings and queens. They have a more prophetic role somehow. They are there to judge in issues and to bring some rulership, but very much seeing that God is the king. And it's at that time, you know that, both because this book actually falls after the book of Judges and before Samuel, where the kings kind of get set up. And also it tells you in verse 1 of chapter 1. So we're in the time of Judges. And I've given the title Grace and Redemption, which are kind of big religious type words. I could have just called it kindness, I suppose. But grace and redemption really is what we're talking about. And from the passage that Nigel read at the beginning, this verse in Ruth 2 verse 12, which actually does give us a hint about what I was talking about earlier, that behind the scenes there is a recognition of this other God love story. May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Well, as we'll see in the story, nothing overtly has taken place with that. Ruth has moved into a foreign land. But Boaz, who's speaking, can see, actually, he's a godly man, as we'll see. He can see that under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Ruth, who he's talking to, actually, that's where she's positioning herself. May he reward you fully for what you have done. Now, as I read through the book, forgive me, maybe it's the way my mind works. Maybe it's just I watch too much television, too many box sets. I kind of saw this as a little bit like a script from which we could make a short Netflix series of a three-episode drama. Ruth, it'll look quite good on the screen like that, don't you think? And so I'm going to kind of pitch this to you a little bit like pitching to someone who, you know, I'm trying to convince they want to make this program. Ruth! And it might have in sort of small, because it kind of works. Grace and Redemption would work on Netflix, you know, because you get enigmatic titles like that as well. So Ruth, Grace and Redemption. So, as the opening music begins, we see three women, one perhaps in her 50s, late 50s perhaps, and they're walking down a road. There's the older lady and then two younger women who are maybe in their late 20s. And they're walking on the road from Moab to Judah. Now, it being Netflix, you're going to have a signpost up there saying Judah so many miles or something, but there we go. They're loaded up with belongings. And they're walking with purpose. They're obviously not just out for an afternoon stroll, but they're walking slowly. And as the camera pans across them, you see, first of all, it dwells on the older lady, and her line is etched with pain and sadness. And you can see there's a lot that's gone on in her life. The camera would dwell there for a while. And then it would go to one of the other younger ladies, and she's looking really full of fear. And finally, it goes to the third lady. And yes, there's obviously nervousness and trepidation in her eyes as well. But as the camera dwells on her face, you see something else in her eyes. You see that behind the nervousness and the trepidation, there is maybe some hope. And then the older lady speaks for the first time, and she says, "Stop! Wait. I've got something to say to you." And as it does with some of these, we then go back in time. And we have Naomi's story. Naomi's story is really the tale of three locations. In the storyline, we would now go back to Bethlehem. And it's a younger Naomi. And she's busy around the house with her husband, and they're happily married. She's married to Elimelech, and they are living in Bethlehem. Yes, that same place we heard about just about a month ago. Only back in time from then. Naomi's own name means pleasant and kind. And both names, Elimelech, his name means God is the king. She's pleasant and kind. That kind of sums up to do with their marriage, I think. Bethlehem is a good place to live. The name Bethlehem means house of bread. It's a place where there's grain, and everything seems to be good. And in time, they've had two sons, and sons are really good news at that point in history. This means you've got inheritance, and things are going to carry on, and your land is going to be handed on, and everything's going to be good. But as the story goes on, you see that problems begin to start. Even though Bethlehem is the house of bread, for some reason, to do with the climate, I guess, there begins to become a shortage of food. And these two sons, well, things are maybe not so good with them either, even at a young age. Now, names in the Bible, you know, they're important. They often mean something very important. And these two guys are called, well, it's actually Mahlon and Chilion. But this being Netflix, I'm going to call them Marlon and Chili. So Marlon and Chili, Mahlon and Chili. Now, I don't know whether these are actually the names they were given at birth, because if so, it maybe wasn't such a great idea from Elimelech. I think probably they may well have been the sort of nicknames they were given in later life, because Mahlon means sick and Chilion means wasting away. So the two sons are sick and wasting away. So maybe that gives us a sort of a hint of what might going to happen a bit later on. But, you know, things are kind of going downhill. Naomi's story is a bit like one of those graphs that go up and down. And, you know, we started on a high, but now it's beginning to go down. And Elimelech makes the decision that they need to decamp to a place called Moab. Now, Moab, interesting place for them to go. Obviously, they went because they heard there was food there, but it wasn't the easiest place for them to go. Moab kind of typically, they weren't at war with Israel, but it was a place that was consistently seen as being one of the enemies of Israel. And it's some of that might go back to the origins of Moab, which reads like something out of a Jeremy Kyle show. You can read it for yourself in Genesis 19. Basically, it's the story of Lot and his two daughters. And I'm going to try and put this as sensitively as possible. But basically, the two daughters decided that there weren't any blokes around that they could carry on their family line with. There was just their dad. And they basically got their dad drunk, and both of them ended up pregnant. So at the sort of root, and that's where the nation of Moab came from. So you can see why Israel maybe weren't so. If you're looking like you don't believe me, Elaine, read it. It's there, Genesis 19. So there's kind of incest at the foundation of the nation. Anyway, Amalek, they've been in Moab for a while, and the grass goes down even. It maybe it's going off a little bit because they've settled and it seems okay, but Amalek dies. But never mind, she's still left with her two sons, and they get married, and they're married to some lovely women. The name Orpah means gazelle, Ruth means friendship, and the graph is going up, but then sickness and wasting away both fulfill the destiny of their names, and both the sons die. So now Naomi is left with two daughters-in-law living in a foreign land, and she decides it's time for them to go back to Bethlehem. There's food there once more. Naomi's now a broken down and quite a bitter woman, and she is blaming God for all the suffering in her life. And you know what? That's not unusual, is it? God does get a bad press. And she says things like this. The Lord has raised his fist against me. She's wrong. She's wrong. There is actually a love story going on in the background here with, as we will see, God trying to work all things together. I used the word trying there, but you understand what I mean. God working all things together for good as people make their own choices. But it's a common reaction, isn't it? God gets a lot of bad press. And that now brings us back to where the episode one started. Here they are on the road. Stop, I've got something to say to you. And Naomi, even though it would put her in an even more insecure position, she decides that she needs to give the option to these daughters-in-law not to go with her back to Bethlehem, but to stay in their homeland. And there's some to-ing and fro-ing, and to start with, they both say they're going to stay, but in the end, one of them agrees to go back, and there's no judgment spoken against that in the book as we read it. It's an understandable decision. But Ruth carries on. And as they go back to Bethlehem, we're still looking at Naomi's story. She gets a measure of security as her daughter-in-law adopts, takes on some responsibility. She says she's going to go out and work. She's going to go and glean in the fields. And just to explain what that's all about, it was the time of harvest. And under the law of the land at the time, when you harvested your field, you were not allowed to harvest right up to the edge of the field. Built into the whole way that the law was put together was a care for those who didn't have enough. So when the harvesters went along the line, they had to leave a gap at the edge of the field so that those who were poor could come and still gather up stuff from the edges of the field. That was built into the law. So that's what Ruth's going to go off and do. She's going to go off and pick up the stuff that gets left behind at the edges of the field and look after her mother-in-law. And that goes well. And as episode one comes to an end, she's coming back and Ruth is going to come back and tell Naomi about an interaction with the owner of the field. Episode one comes to an end with an introduction to Boaz. And he is going to be episode two. So what's going on with Boaz? Well, we're told a bit about him. We're told in the beginning of chapter two of Ruth that he's a wealthy man. He's an influential man. He's a relative of Naomi's late husband. And as the story progresses, we find out more about him. We find out that he is a man of compassion. He takes compassion on Ruth and Naomi because he knows the connection between them, or he discovers it. He goes beyond what was required in terms of the law. The law said you just got to leave the stuff at the edge, but Boaz goes further than that. He actually makes sure that Ruth gets more than that, that she's looked after. He gives her more than she's expecting. He feeds her with more than enough so that Naomi can also be helped. He goes beyond what was required. He's a man of integrity. He obviously looks after his workers. They're being fed and being looked after well. He doesn't take advantage, as the story progresses, of a situation where things could have gone very differently. In chapter 3, we read Ruth, on the instructions of her mother-in-law, she goes to visit Boaz at night, in the middle of the night. And she actually symbolically asks him to marry her. But, you know, here is an older man with a younger woman visiting him in the middle of the night. A younger woman who is vulnerable, who's a foreigner. She's in a position of great weakness and vulnerability. And sadly, we could see the story going a very different way at that point, with him taking advantage of her, sleeping with her, destroying her reputation and her name, destroying her life. But he doesn't. He's a man of integrity. He's a man of integrity in terms of fulfilling his obligations. Now, he was a relative. And without going into all of the details, which I'm a little bit hazy about anyway, he is what was called a kinsman redeemer. In other words, if you ended up without, if your husband died, then you could legitimately expect some other male relative of his to, if he was able to take you on, to marry you, to include you into his household. And Boaz was someone who could take that position with Ruth because of her relationship with Naomi. He fulfills that obligation. He doesn't say, well, I'm not going to do that. You're a foreigner, and I'm sure there's a loophole here somewhere. Also, he's a man of integrity because actually he knows there's someone who has a prior claim. Ruth, by all accounts, is an attractive, eligible woman. He could have said, I'll grab this opportunity while I can. As far as we know, he's single. There's no mention of other wives or other children. But he's an older man. He says that himself. Here's this fantastic opportunity, but he doesn't take advantage of it. He makes sure he goes through the proper process. I think we've already seen that he's a godly man. He greets his workers by saying, the Lord be with you. And he sees God at work in Ruth's life from that verse in chapter 2, verse 12 that we've read out. He's also, and maybe this explains a little bit about his desire to help the outcast, he is a man with, well, I should really say, a family history. Because here he is now, a wealthy and influential man. But in his past, now, it's unclear whether it's his mother. The timeline probably means it was a grandmother. And the Hebrew word that's, sorry, the Greek word is, by the time we read this, could mean either, really. But if you look in Matthew and chapter 1, there's a kind of a timeline of family history going through to Jesus and going through, including David. And in there, we read that either mother, but probably grandmother of Boaz, is one lady called Rahab. Anyone familiar with Rahab? Rahab, who unfortunately for her, often almost like it's her surname, just gets called Rahab the harlot. She's the lady who looks after the spies going into Jericho. You can read that story for yourself. Some commentators say that maybe she wasn't a prostitute. Maybe the word could be translated as just a lady who looked after the inn. But most still seem to call her Rahab the prostitute, who showed kindness to some of God's people. And because of that, gets really good press in the Bible. And she is one of Boaz's relatives. So maybe living through that in the family had an effect on Boaz. Maybe that's why he felt able to show more compassion himself. And episode 3, well, of course, the person who holds the whole story together, Ruth's story. And we would go back in time if this was Netflix, and in her episode, we would first of all see her back in Moab, meeting her husband-to-be, marrying him, becoming part of this new family, finding a new faith in their God. Possibly that's what drives her to, in her faithfulness to Naomi. She finds a new faith. Somehow the tragedy of her, first of all, her father-in-law's premature death and her brother-in-law's husband's death and her brother-in-law's death. Somehow in all of that, there is something there. Maybe it's her new faith that means that she doesn't get bitter. Back in Bethlehem, she creates quite a reputation from her kindness to Naomi. But, you know, that sacrificial love had risks. She was a foreigner going to a land as fundamentally an immigrant, where she wouldn't necessarily be welcomed in. I'm sure there was suspicion of her when she first got back to Bethlehem, which had never been her home before. But she is self-sacrificing in her love. She doesn't just sit back and say, Naomi, this is your land. You better do something about this. No, she goes out and takes initiative and works in the field. Her kindness to Naomi, you kind of get the impression it's a bit unexpected, really, by the local people, because it's obviously talked about. Boaz says, oh, I've heard all about you. I've heard about the kindness you've shown your mother-in-law, Naomi. Self-sacrificing love actually creates an impression. And as we went through to the end of her story, we would see it's a story about inclusion. This immigrant who's gone out on a limb to help someone actually ends up being included in. She's included in by Boaz. She's asked him to marry her. He does marry her. That's the happy end to the love story. She seems to be welcomed in by the community. And behind all of this, she's included in by God. When she meets Boaz in the night, back in chapter 3, she says to him, spread the hem of your garment over me, which sounds like a bit of a strange thing to us, and it actually perhaps sounds a bit suggestive, but it's not, according to the commentators. Basically, it's a symbolic expression, because the hem was the place of authority, was seen as the place of authority in the Jewish garment. And she's basically saying, I want to come under your authority. I want to come under your covering. She sees initially this human answer, but Boaz, almost prophetically back in chapter 2, has already seen that actually the covering she's coming under is under the wings of the Almighty God. She's included in. And in that, we'll see that there's inclusion through her choices and through Boaz's choices, but through her initiative, through this thread running through the story, there's actually much wider inclusion being worked out by our loving God. So, there's the Netflix series, and the director would probably want to know, yeah, but what's some of the motivations going on here, Andy? Okay, here's the stories, but what's coming out of some of the backstory, the motivations? Well, it's in grace and redemption. First of all, there is the human story. And there's some very straightforward things here. Naomi shows grace and kindness to Orpha and Ruth. She gives them the option of going home. She doesn't have to. She could have said, look, these are my daughters and all, you need to look after me. No, she gives them the option. She does show grace and kindness. Even in the midst of her own bitterness about her own life, she shows grace and kindness to them. Ruth, of course, shows grace and kindness back to Naomi. She shows this sacrificial love. Boaz shows grace and kindness to Ruth. He does look after her, first of all in the field, and then actually really looking after her and marrying her. And in terms of redemption, each one of these human stories, we see their situations being turned around. We see even though the graph has gone down, it goes up. Boaz, all right, he's wealthy and influential, but it seems he's single for whatever reason. It seems he's childless, and he finds this fulfillment in Ruth. There is redemption in the human story, but there is also God's big story going on as well. And part of that is to do with what I referred to just now. And that's this family line of David that we read in Matthew chapter 1. And some of it is actually at the end of the book of Ruth. There's all of these elements within this which has got backgrounds in it that are, if I can put it this way, less than perfect. And somehow these less than perfect stories, less than perfect family backgrounds, get woven together, resulting in, first of all, being part of the family history of David, the greatest king of Israel, and then on down through to Jesus in terms of human family. You see, it's not just a coincidence that this is taking place in Bethlehem. Why are Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem, the Christmas story? They're going there because in terms of the tax census, everyone has to go back to the town of their family history. It says they went to Bethlehem because Joseph was of the house and lineage of David. And so in this story of these extraordinary backgrounds getting woven together of love, of people doing self-sacrificial love, of people welcoming in the outcast, of people going above and beyond what could be expected in terms of the law in showing grace, all of this reaches its fulfillment in Jesus. And some of those themes sound very familiar when we think about Jesus, don't they? What are some of those stories? Well, we've mentioned Moab with Lot's daughters deciding to take matters into their own hands. There's another one there which gets mentioned in Ruth chapter 4, Tamar and her father-in-law, Judah, and by posing as a prostitute in Genesis 38, she does much the same thing as Lot's daughters did in order to try and preserve her family line with her father-in-law. And Rahab that we've talked about, the probably prostitute. Backgrounds where people could have written them off, but God has not written them off. And how about us? How about our story? In times of difficulty, and I'm really not being glib here, but you know, Naomi has a lot thrown at her. She goes into bitterness, but actually maybe through Ruth's kindness finds a place of faith again. How will we respond? Will we respond in loving faithfulness to each other and to other people, actually paying the price, love being an action, not just a word? How does this story speak to us about our acceptance of the marginalized, of the outcast, of the immigrant? A word we've used many times this morning, how does this story speak to us about kindness? Kindness is a very underrated thing. And I'm just going to declare my sources here in preparing this. At the same time as this, a young lady called Maddie May from the Maidenhead Church was preparing. She's speaking right now, and she just wanted to share some ideas with me about what she was preparing. And kindness was at the heart of what she's speaking about this morning. And that really spoke to me. You know, kindness, as we've seen with all of those post-it notes, it's something we can all do, and we can write it off. You know, many years ago, when my wife and I were 27 years old, I won't tell you how long ago that was. Not just for our benefit. We'd moved to a new town, and in doing that, for all sorts of reasons that some of you know and the rest of you don't need to be bothered with, we'd kind of left behind our friends purposely, not because we didn't like them and they didn't like us, but there was a job we needed to do in this new town. It meant kind of not being to and fro back to where we were all the time. And so actually, we were kind of on our own almost there in this new town, trying to get a job done in a church. And quite early on, a young teenage couple, they weren't really, they were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time, took us out for a meal to a Pizza Hut restaurant. And we thought they wanted to talk to us about obviously, maybe some problems they had. You know, we were 27 and they were teenage. Obviously, we were going to help them. And actually, over the meal, the guy said, you know, we've realized that you haven't got any friends here and you must be lonely. And if it's okay, we'd like to be your friends. And that was just a simple act of kindness. And Rob and Sharon Haywood are still our friends. And that act of kindness had ripples and reverberations in terms of our relationship, which is lifelong so far. Will always be. But also actually has had all sorts of kingdom impact as well. Simple acts of kindness. And finally, God's work in and through us, whatever our background or history. Don't write yourself off because of your background. God wants to work in your life. And just finally, see, perhaps like Ruth this morning, you think that maybe you're entitled to get something from the edge of God's kindness. Because that's the law. That's what he has to do. Maybe you've come here this morning feeling, well, maybe there'll just be a few little things to pick up at the edge. I'm not worth any more than that. But God wants to bring you much, much more than that. He wants to give you more than you expect from the very center of his goodness because of his grace. Let me just shut our eyes just literally for 60 seconds. What is God saying to us about how we respond to others? But also, what is he saying to us about how God responds to us?